Hello, it is April 24th, 2017. You're looking live at Athens, Georgia. This is episode 640 of the Will Leach Experience Podcast on Sports North. I am the Will Leach, aforementioned Will Leach. I thank you for spending part of your day with me. I am delighted to have as my guest today one of my favorite baseball writers in the world, and not just one of my favorite baseball writers, but one of the smarter people to read on all variety of topics on his site, meadowparty.com and elsewhere. It is Keith Law, senior baseball writer for ESPN and author of the new book, Smart Baseball, and one of my favorite people in the world. How are you, Keith?
I am good. How are you?
I am mirthful. I am full of mirth on this.
By the way, this will be the first time I hear you on a podcast sans Tim.
Yeah.
Unless he's like hiding. I don't know. Is he like lurking on the podcast? Or are we going to talk Fletch?
We will say you are referring to the Grierson Leach podcast. I will note that Tim, let's just call him predisposed. We'll just go with that. We'll just call him predisposed. Quiet down there. Okay. So Keith, I'm very delighted. I have a million questions for you. Only some of which are about the book, but we're going to start with
those.
Okay. Because that's what we're here for. And I love the book. You know, it's funny. It's always a funny thing. I talked to Ben Lindbergh about this because I listen to his podcast a lot and I've read a lot of his work. And it's always a strange thing when I talked to Chuck Klosterman about this one time too. When you've read like a bunch of someone's stuff and you really feel like you really know their voice, and then you read the book, a book that they wrote, which is, you know, it's different. Like it's still the same voice, but you know, and what I found, it's just a different experience. So you're writing in a larger package. One of the things I found fascinating about the book is, listen, there is a certain segment of the internet world that considers you snarky or considers you someone, and I guess that's slightly the case, but I have to say, I've always found you more. I'm sure you'll be very upset to hear this. I usually found you more just right than necessarily
this
snarky.
Works for me also.
But one thing that I found interesting about the book is, you know, this is not a snarky book, to be honest. Like you've put a conscious effort to make sure that the book if you are into baseball, but like wary of all of these kind of fights that go on between baseball people, here is a way to logically explain this to you. It seems not that you're always warm-hearted. You are always warm-hearted, but this definitely feels very, here, come on in. If you don't know this stuff, I don't think you're an idiot. That seemed like a conscious decision.
Yes, 100%. You're not the first person to say, in fact, a good friend of mine, Joe Sheehan, read the book and said, it's not you. Where is all the snark? And I tried to slip in a little humor where I could, but my fear, especially in those early chapters where I'm going after the traditional stats that I very much grew up believing in, was if I came at those with the same tone that I might take on Twitter when someone is arguing creationism or vaccine denial with me, I would lose everybody.
Right.
You know, you can't do that. I suppose I could write that book, but who would read it then? Only the previously convinced would be reading it. And that was not the purpose of this book. I want this to be the book for just about everybody. And even if you come in ranting about saber nerds, if I start talking about that, I'm going to get snarky and I'm going to defeat my entire purpose here. But, you know, I want everybody to feel like, yes, like you said, come in. I'm going to explain this to you. It may sound even a little didactic at points, but hopefully I will convince you with my arguments. And then all I want to do is open people's minds so that as we get into the second and the third section, now I'm probably telling you stuff you haven't heard before. If you've been in the industry, yes. But if you're outside the industry, no, a lot of this is going to be, you know, at some point there's that inflection point in the book where I'm telling you new stuff. And again, no one's going to pay attention if I'm just snarky and obnoxious all the way through the book.
And this is something I've always both admired about you, but also like always, it's something I don't have myself. You know, you've always been a big presence on Twitter and you've been willing to be combative in defense of your points. And the thing with me is I'm not really willing to be combative in defense of my points. Like, that's to say that I believe that I am right, but there's a certain level. I wonder if part of it is just being involved in the early days of Deadspin when everyone was yelling at me all the time, that to me, like at a certain level, like I'm kind of done with it. Like I'm really getting in fights with people who disagree with me online it just, I find it so kind of spiritually exhausting in a way that that I just kind of can't do it anymore. And so therefore, and there are times I have to say, I worry that, man, am I losing something? Are people not reading me or fewer people reading me because I'm not yelling at someone? Or I'm not turning this. And you see this a little bit. Listen, there are people on our side of this stuff, like a Brian Kinney, for example, who I think is generally, you know, I mean, we can disagree here or there, but like he's generally on the right side of these tests, but his is a much more a you're wrong and you're stupid and kill the wind and so on. And even when I find myself like agreeing with him, I'm always like, all right, easy, easy little bit.
Everyone's kind of got their own, you know, right. tone. You have to, like what I do when I argue with people, and I do it less now than I did a couple years ago, because as you said, it can become extremely exhausting. And I really try to do it, if I'm going to argue with someone in view of other people, it better be funny. If it's not funny, then what then there's no point to doing it. But it is genuine in that most of these people who try to argue, you know, say, let's, you know, stick to the baseball thing. If they're arguing old stats with me at some point, you know, their tone is probably one that they wouldn't take if they saw me at a baseball game, sat down with me and said, hey, let's talk about some of these old stats. But if they did, I'm going to hit them right back the same way you see me talk to them on Twitter. I hope at least that's my real voice. Like, I'm not playing so much of a character on Twitter that I'm arguing with people. And I do stick to things I genuinely believe in. I'll argue for science topics, but then there are a lot of topics in politics and economics and stuff I just don't know enough about. And so people often try to pick fights with me on some really weird topics sometimes. Often I have no idea why, 'cause it's like I've never written about that. You're confusing me with, you know, I don't even know. I'm not even sure of a good analogy to make. But basically, yeah, people want to get me in to argue with them. And it's like, if I don't know anything about it, I'm not going there. But in this realm, like, this has been my life for 15 years. I have some strong opinions and I think I can back them up okay. And in the book, I have more time to do that. And on Twitter, you have 140 characters. Sometimes it's better to make a quick point and then make a joke and get out.
Yeah, I do think this is proof, though, that you're losing your touch on Twitter if you are unwilling to engage people strongly on ideas that you don't quite understand.
Right.
That
makes sense.
I think you're failing a little bit on Twitter. One of the things I really like about the book, too, is, you know, because, again, I, like you, I've been invested in this stuff for a long time. And, you know I remember you know, I, like a lot of people, my gateway drug was Rob Nyer. I think Rob Nyer, yes, for a lot of people, like, you know, reading it, I remember being, you know, not working in sports at all and just really liking baseball, all of a sudden being like, holy shit, a walk is as good as a hit. This is amazing. I love this sport. And why am I so stupid that I'm not realizing all these things? And you kind of, one of the things I love about the book is you kind of chart that a little bit and you kind of go through that idea. But I'm curious, you know, I look back and I think about how far everything has come and how much the thinking on this has made, but there's still a little part of me that's like, man, this book is awesome and totally explains this in a rational way that any well-meaning, reasonable person cannot deny. But if you'd have told me 10 years ago that we would still be having some of the fights, like this, I wonder if this is more of a media problem, because within baseball, it feels like the fight's over. Is it just a media battle, or is this within the game as well?
It's a media battle, and it's still among the readership. Like, ESPN ran that excerpt, a portion of my of the chapter on clutch hits and lineup protection, about how they don't exist. They ran a section of that chapter where I discuss sacrifice bunts and specifically why most sacrifice bunts are stupid. And so ESPN's main account tweeted a link to that, which is wonderful. You should see the replies. I mean, it was a horror show. I weep for the future of our species. Because, first of all, because 90% of them just said rude things to me without reading the article at all, clearly. They read the headline and immediately responded, which I guess is how you're supposed to use Twitter. I've just never really gotten on. Like, I think if you're going to comment on something, you should probably read the article first. That's just kind of how I
old operate. School. So old school you.
Apparently so. I am. I'm 43. I'm getting up there. You know, I remember when books were on paper and I had to dial a phone. Like, my daughter saw that in an episode. I don't even remember what show it was. When she said, What is that? She saw a rotary phone. What is that? Oh God. Yes,
that was the thing that usually you were killed by the murderer when you were still ringing the 9 in the 911.
That's right. That's
all the
exactly
way up.
Right.
So the
responses to that were really indicated to me that, there's plenty of market for this book, that there are a lot of people who still haven't heard these arguments, or maybe have chosen not to hear the arguments, that they don't want to know. Somebody was ranting at me again without reading. He's telling me my book sucks without actually reading the book, which is always fun. About how stats have ruined baseball, new stats. He's referring to sabermetrics, and that OBP nerds, I think that's what it was, OBP heads, it might have been, can't explain why run scoring has been dropping, which is particularly funny because run scoring has moved almost completely in tandem with league-wide on-base percentages. So that's certainly the reason that it's been – like we got this one. We're good. But there's so much of that knee-jerk like, no, that's not how it was. That's not what I grew up with. That's not what dad or mom told me about baseball, and they just don't. Like I said, to me, it reads like they don't want to hear it. And again, that's okay. It allowed me to write the book because I think there's an audience for it. But at the same time, I'm with you. Like, how we're still doing this. We are finally at the point, like Mike Trout winning the MVP last year. It's like, have we turned that corner? Finally turned that corner now? We're not still arguing over RBIs and the guy has to be in the playoffs. You know, I have some hope, and then my hopes will be dashed this October because there'll be something – they'll do something silly again.
And what's strange about this is within the game itself, this is solved. Like Tony La Russa and Dave Stewart don't run a team anymore. So there's nobody left. So to me, that seems particularly frustrating because now, you know, it is frankly like everything else in American culture right now. You are, I've been reading Joe Sheehan, he's been doing that fellowship, not whatever the term it is, residentship at Fangraphs this week.
Yes.
And one of the things I find interesting about that, one of the things I love about your writing and Joe's writing is it is certainly using the concepts of advanced analytics in baseball, but it is written in, they're written for regular people. So sometimes I find some of the higher level stuff a little bit too dense. As someone that even that agrees with it and understands it and loves it, sometimes it's a little bit too much. And what's interesting though is it feels so much kind of like the rest of American society is. So we've got this group of people over here, like you, like me, like Joe, your Fangraphs readers, and we're all like, "This is so." Or also people that work within the game, the people that actually like, make the decisions in the game. We're all over here, and we're being like, "This is." This is the earth is not flat. This is vaccinating your children is good. This is not like this is solved. This is solved science. And then you have whether it's a larger group or not, I think in baseball it's a larger group, and I think electorally it's not, but it seems so because of an antiquated system. But that's a different conversation. but more to the point, you know, there's this group of people over here that you can tell them this stuff, and their answers are going to be like you said. It ruined baseball. You guys can't explain this thing. This is stupid. You're nerds and so on. I'm curious for you to make the decision to write the book this way, which again, I appreciate it, and temperamentally I appreciate it because that is the way that I still have this perhaps stupid thought that if you're just like, okay. We're all on the same team. We're all human beings. We're all going to die someday. We're all on this rotating orb for just a limited amount of time. And when I see you on the street, I know you will not, in fact, be as rude to me as you are in the internet world. So if we can all talk, like otherwise people would constantly be shooting each other in the street, which I suppose is not that far away. But more to the point.
Right. Well, Blade Runner 2048 is coming out shortly. We're there.
Yeah. Well, if we're going to go down, we're going to go down looking like Gosling. so my point is that it is an extra level. It feels like a parallel to, frankly, American culture and American politics and the idea that you've got two options that you could have done with this book. You could have said, hey, fellow, you could have done the Fire Joe Morgan idea. Which is, and I love Fire Joe Morgan, and I love Michael Schur, and I love those guys. But you could have done these people are idiots, let's all laugh at them. And I would have loved every minute of that book.
Of course.
And, yes. Or you can do, and I'm sure you've done a great job of it, or you can go this way and try to say, like, this is the way that it is, and just come with me on this journey. Is it frustrating to you? This is the I'll lead to this question. Is it frustrating to you that either way you would have done that book, people would still be yelling at you that way?
Yes. Absolutely 100% true. You know, and there's part of me like, obviously we've met, so you know what I'm like in person too. And there, you know, the combative stuff you see on Twitter is really a function of the medium more than anything, but I would not like choose to be like ultra combative over the course of a 300 page book. Like, frankly, I think I would find it tiring. The great thing about Fire Joe Morgan is they would take one column a week and tear it to shreds, and do it absolutely beautifully. I think I would have had a very hard time doing that. I would have had a hard time. Like, some of these bad columns are written by people I know, which is also a little awkward. I'm just going to, you know, sometimes just pretend I didn't see that one. We're still going to be friends. I just didn't read that thing you wrote.
This feels like you're subtweeting me on my own podcast. Yeah.
Actually, I'm talking about your film criticism. Ah! Here.
Okay, sorry, go ahead.
Warcraft was a masterpiece.
Yes, sure.
Actually, we should argue about Fletch because you wrecked – your distaste for bad 80s comedies runs directly counter to my nostalgia gene. So.
Yeah, I understand. Yes. But that same nostalgia would drive you nuts in baseball. Just
yes, this is absolutely – this is very, very true. I mean, I thought there have been and there will continue to be columns – these sort of sepia-toned looks back on the old days when we didn't have OPS and men were men and pitchers threw 300 pitches a game and you can't measure heart and it's the same shit every time. Like, that's still going to come. I do hope at least now that someone will read one of those columns and maybe has also read my book and will compare the two and say, you know, one of these is really well argued and one of these is polemic, basically. And I did not want to write it. I want to write a screed. I felt like I was trying to convince the invisible reader of my points. And to do so, like you said earlier, I'm glad you sort of picked up, like, this, there's not much math in the book. I really did not want a lot of math in the book, and I was not going to get into really detailed modeling of scenarios, and there's not a lot of formulas. That's by design. This is the philosophy, because that mirrors what's going on in baseball. Like, 30 teams have 30 different ways to measure defense. They all agree you can measure defense, and they all said basically, we got better data than you have. You want to look at UZR and DRS, that stuff's good, but what we have is better. And to me, there's a little parallel, like you brought up, we've both sort of brought up the anti-science mood in America, the anti-intellectualism overall. Like, I look at the creationism evolution thing. Like, there's still a huge amount of research being done on how evolution works, and that will probably go on for hundreds of years that we're still figuring this out. But we know evolution, right? That's the evolution, period. Full stop. We're good with that. And there are still people who are, you know, have their fingers in their ears and are just, you know, creationists, anti-evolutionists, whatever you want to call them. They're denying that this stuff is settled. And to me, it's not like we have perfect formulas for measuring anything in baseball, but we have at least gotten to the point that we've all agreed, all 30 teams and an increasing portion of the media, we can and should measure this stuff. We have the tools, we have the technology, and this is the way to approach valuing players and projecting forward on players. If you can't get on board with that, then you're outside. You are in denial because the whole industry has just raced ahead of you. Like you said, now that Dave Stewart's done because he had better things to do than running the Diamondbacks into the ground, now everybody's got an analytics department. They're all doing this kind of work.
One of the strange criticisms of this that I don't really get, and it seems even counterintuitive to the argument, is the idea that somehow these stats make baseball less fun. And to me, the only one I've come up with, that the only argument I'm willing to even grant, is win probability. That's the one thing, because I know, like, I know it's right, but like, I don't want to know that during the game. Later, I want to go back and be like, wow, look what David Freese's triple did. That was amazing. But like, during the moment, this is my this is probably my main complaint. My only major complaint about the ESPN broadcast is the win probability, other than that the strike zone graphic exists only to make me mad. I'm sure that's the right call
about that. The other day I was just up in Bristol. It's like, strike zone map, is that Has anyone talked to Will? Is he still mad? Oh, no, he's pissed off. All right,
All it does, like, that's literally all it does is be like I'm, in the moment, I'm sure it's correct, but now I'm like, okay, before I'd have been like, ooh, that's a close call, we didn't get it. Now I'm just mad. Like, I want to get mad later. Anyway.
You know, once you put the lines up on the screen, it's definitive, right?
Right.
That was absolutely the accurate strike, and we know that that's, of course, that's not true.
Of course, right. Yeah. And, but for me, and my win probability thing is more just like, I don't know. I just want to be down 3-2. I don't want to be down 67-33.
I don't think we have a good innate sense of, if I tell you the Cardinals are 57% likely to win this game, I don't have a good innate sense of what that means. The difference between 57% likely and 73% likely. Yes, I understand there's a difference between those numbers, but there's no like internal monitor. You know, I have no. There's no sense of that. Is that a lot more? A little more? Yeah. Like, yeah. I understand. I can see the numbers that it's. It looks like quite a bit more, but I don't feel any different about that.
Yeah.
I don't love the stat for anything but what you just described. Like, I tweeted a Fangraphs chart a couple days ago where there was – I forgot who it was. But it was, you know, a 7-run comeback in the bottom of the ninth. Like, that's pretty amazing. Just to show how unlikely that was, it's incredibly useful for that. But the people who say, oh, this stuff makes baseball less fun, like, I don't know. I like information. Right. I always have. Like, everything I do, all my hobbies, like, I want to learn more. I always want to learn more about what's going on, whether it's in the moment or afterwards. Like, hey, Aaron Judge just smoked that ball. Oh, turns out it was one of the 5 hardest hit balls of the entire season. That's pretty cool. I didn't need it that very second. Finding that out did not in any way detract from my enjoyment of watching him take the covers off of a baseball. Like, that's – to me, this stuff's amazing. I focus a little bit on spin rate because – I think that's one that's even changing scouting, where that's something we would traditionally ask scouts, like, all right, grade the curveball. Oh, he's got really tight spin on that curveball. Actually, now we have a number for that. I find that really useful. It means we should ask scouts to do different things, certainly. And I understand that can be scary for people because we're talking about their livelihoods here. But the fact that we can quantify stuff like that to me is awesome. Like, I've always wanted to know. I mean, I've been looking at breaking balls and saying, I think that's got tight spin. Hey, was I right?
Yeah.
Now you can tell me if I was close. I'd like to know that.
Yeah, and you know, you kind of close the book, not entirely close, but toward the end, you talk about Statcast a lot. You know, I was a part of the MLB Plus podcast with Mike Petriello that we did last year. Of course, Statcast being a big part of MLB Advanced Media. And one of the things for me, talking about making it fun, I don't understand why learning, like, wow, look what these people are physically capable of doing. One of the things that's been great for me about Statcast is this: it puts myth to this notion that, like, baseball players are somehow, like, they're somehow the least athletic of the major sports or so on.
Sure.
When you look and see what they're doing on what StatCast tells you what they're doing, to me, forget, like, even if I don't understand launch angle or I don't understand round efficiency, just to, like, literally see, look how physically far he hit that ball. Look how fast it was going off the bat. Look how fast he runs. Just in a basic thing, that is exciting. Just even if I'm not even a huge baseball fan, just, like, as a fan of, like, physical achievement, it's like it's opened my eyes to so many things that I wouldn't have even thought about before.
That's, I mean, it dovetails so well with what I love about baseball. Like, I love watching athletes do their thing. Like, whether I'm going to a high school game or the big leagues or anything in between, like, the athletes are the ones who catch your eye, and they do it with athletic feats. It's running, it's hitting the ball hard, it's what they can do on the mound to throw hard or make it move in ways that seem like they defy physics. That's the stuff I think most people like about baseball. And all StatCast does is put more insight onto that. And it may focus us on different things too. Like, did you ever think about launch angle before? My guess is a lot of fans probably didn't. And I think it's changed. Scouts always did, because we were, all right, it's got to have some loft in his finish. A guy with a flat swing isn't going to hit for any power. Well, it turns out now we know that too much loft is a bad thing. You're just hitting it up in the air and not actually getting maximum power, that there's this range there around between 20 and 25 degrees or so seems to be the optimal launch angle to hit for power. So that's made fans look at something maybe that they weren't looking at before, and also changed the opinions of a lot of people in the industry that, you know, don't get too far under the ball. There is really such a thing as an uppercut style of swing that is detrimental to your ability to hit for power. So it has changed it for everybody, but I think it's all for the better. If you're learning more, I mean, I just have the opinion, if you're learning more about something that you love, then you're better off.
one of the things I've always kind of admired about your career is, you know, you obviously started in the early days of the stuff. I was reading you a long time ago, but then of course you went to go work for the Blue Jays and became. We all remember the old. You talk about this in the book, the old scouts versus stat heads kind of silly argument, as if like these people were one person wanted players to be bad and one person right. players to be good. Like they're obviously all on the same team. But I've always kind of admired how you were able to go now. I mean, in the early days, that was the thing. That was a criticism of the prospectus people was they don't watch games. They don't see stuff with the eyes. I always kind of appreciated there was an intellectual rigor, I thought, to wanting to round out that side of it and merge those two sides. But it's fascinating because, you know, you have a line in the end of the book, and you've talked about this before, about how you would be unqualified for your current position right. with the Blue Jays. Could you expand on that a little? Because I don't know. I still feel like you do okay.
It would have to be a different job. I mean, what I was doing with the Blue Jays was I was the analytics department. And the analytics department ran in things like Excel and Access and a bunch of Perl scripts I wrote to handle, like, you know, processing split data for minor league baseball or scraping college baseball teams' websites to pull all their stats into a single place. So much of my job was merely data collection rather than the type of heavy database analysis that I describe in the book, and that teams analytics departments, which can run to 13 and 14 employees now, I think the Dodgers are in that range at least. The type of work that they're doing, I mean, they have more data, right? StatCast is a terabyte and a half of data every year. That's not going to fit on my laptop. But so it's several orders of magnitude more sophisticated than what I was doing, which again was largely just data collection, presentation. Running certain filters on guys in the draft where, look, the scouts are already sort of pre-selecting a lot of players. Let's find ways to compare them to each other so that we can add to the rankings. It was very lightweight. If I were – I'm not going back to a front office, but if I were to go back, it would be more likely in a role that touched on scouting, which is something I only learned to do by going to work for the Blue Jays. And after a couple of years, it was the third draft. I remember sitting there – Tony LaCava was still with the Blue Jays and was very much my mentor there. I was sitting to my right and I looked at him. We're in the fourth round. And I said, we don't actually like any of the players left on the board. Like all the, because we weren't taking high school guys. And all the college guys we had put in as number four starters or better, or as potential everyday players or better, were gone. I said, what are we going to, what did we just do? Because we'd stopped scouting 60% of the player pool. And in a time when other clubs like the Cardinals were starting to do the same thing to just plunder the college players, that when you've got eight teams trying to go after the same inefficiency, it's not an inefficiency anymore. You're all just going to be wasting time basically because the teams that were still taking the high school players were much better off for that because we just totally eschewed this portion of the draft pool. And that was where I said, you know, I have to learn how to do this, or at least understand how other people are doing it. And the more I did it, the more I realized I kind of like it. I like going to see young players because for the reason I mentioned earlier, when I walk into a high school field or college field and I'm seeing great young athletes with potential and trying to understand, and now in my present role, it's more explain the differences between them. Like, I love that part of the job. I wish I could do that more. If I didn't have a family to come back to, I'd just live out of a suitcase and go travel 60, 90 days every spring and just go see players all the time.
Yeah, the number of things that we would all do if we had not made the decision to have families. I'm telling right. you. I mean, for once,
propagate the species.
Yes. We would be the busiest, saddest people.
Yeah, that's
be,
right. That's
I would
right.
be so sad.
We would have a lot of Marriott points, though.
Yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
To important. Use on nothing because we have no family to take on vacation.
I always remember I went with my wife to Hawaii a couple of years ago and we fly uh-huh. Delta, and I went to the Delta Sky Express line. She's like, wow, this is so nice. I'm like, yes, this 15 seconds we saved, all it cost me was typing with my loved ones. And
that's right.
Things that I enjoy in the world. All it did was, but hey, we are here 20 seconds faster than those schmucks.
That's right.
So I'm always curious about that too, because like to me, that's quite a transition though in your career. The idea, like something scouting that you never really even thought, I mean, you thought about, but it's not something you certainly had any notion of expertise in until you go to work for the team. And now, like, I mean, you're the definitive, you know, organizational rankings and your top players and that is the thing that you are known for now. Would you? I'm curious because you mentioned you're never going to work for a team, and there were all those Houston rumors a while back and so on. But like, do you? Like, would you be okay with this? Like, you've had such kind of an interesting career, and now you've written this book. Are there other fields you'd like to conquer in baseball? Would you forget the playing for a team? But would you be comfortable doing prospect stuff forever? Do you want to be a big thinker and figure out how to pace a game stuff? I'm curious. Like, what's a field in baseball you feel is even a particular inefficiency in baseball that you think you'd be uniquely skilled to help correct?
I have been working on my split-fingered fastball, and I'm going to try out for teams this summer. And I know it's going to be people looking for starting pitchers. So
it's the blisters.
That's one thing I've never done.
The blisters will ruin you. The blisters will ruin you.
It's a great question because I don't know. Obviously, that's come up quite a bit. People are asking me within the industry, not the baseball industry, but the publishing side. You know, do you want to do another book maybe after this one? I do want to continue to write. What I love more than anything is writing. I love it. I do tons of it. I mean, I think that's something you and I have in common. We just write a lot.
Yeah.
About a lot of different things.
I thought that was the point of all this. It's always strange to me. Like, we do TV stuff. We do all this other stuff. And everyone's I thought the whole point with – only reason I do that stuff is so I can keep writing.
Right, doesn't it? Yes. That's the amount of money we get for television, per whatever unit of time, I guess, versus – the amount we get for writing, it makes no sense unless you put it exactly the way you just did. The television and other work subsidizes the writing. And I mean, frankly, the ESPN job subsidizes the personal blog at The Dish because, I mean, I make a little money off of that. It's not paying the bills, but I love doing it. I just love to sit down and write. And then to interact with readers who are not yelling at me over, a movie review or a food, food column or something like that. I would love to – I have a couple of ideas – that are totally non-baseball, non-sports completely. I would love to sort of take the style of writing and thinking that I have used in baseball and do other stuff. And, maybe for a while I keep doing the prospect stuff because, like you said, it subsidizes some of the other writing. Like, ESPN's been good to me in a lot of ways. And if that means I can go write another book that's about coffee, like, I love coffee and I'm fascinated by the industry of coffee. Like, I would love to go do that. Because I don't know that there's much else I can do in baseball unless I go get a PhD in machine learning and signal processing and become a StatCast expert. I'm not going to do that, by the way. Not happening.
Yeah, that's it's the family again. I would get that same degree. I would get that same degree if I didn't have the opportunity. Okay, a couple more things. One thing I thought was fascinating last year, we talked about Dave Stewart a little bit and that, but I really felt, and I don't know if you felt this way, but certainly felt this way from the outside, that piece where you wrote, where I think you broke down really just how dysfunctional is not quite right. It was a little dysfunctional, but it was more just almost disinterested and confused. that kind of, or dysfunctional requires at least a little bit of function. That's failing. And whereas this seemed to just kind of, and there was the weirdness of Stewart's wife being an agent and all this other strange stuff. But to me, what was fascinating about that was that piece clearly, I find it difficult to argue, is not – I don't think it's the reason that they made the change, but I think it clearly put stuff into motion. I think clearly – like, there were people that read that were close to the Dynamax and said, wow, this is a bigger mess than I thought. Now I'm curious. You obviously spent a lot of time in Arizona. Was that as particular – like, that's also – that was partly scouting, but it was also outside of scouting a little bit. I read that, and I was like, wow, I would love to read a Keith Law piece on every organization. It's like, how are they running – so first off, if you could get on that, that'd be great.
Oh yeah, excellent. Yeah.
But 30 for 30, right. Exactly. But yeah, 30 and 30 days would be perfect, actually. That would be awesome. Okay. If Monday, I'm actually I got some straight time in the afternoon. If you could have everybody by then, that would be great. But I'm curious, like, that was as close, I would say, as I find as a regular reader of yours, that you come to, like, I don't like to use the word hot takes. I prefer bold proclamations just because it's just more annoying. Yeah, I don't have to be associated with that little Venn diagram of people. I thought, well, alternate universe, I think Keith could do this pretty well. Was that a piece that you'd like to do more of? Was that a piece that you felt like, or was that just like, I have to correct this wrong and I feel like I have to be the one to do it?
By the way, you've got me wondering if discompetent could be a word. Like, that might actually really apply, that it was almost like an actual antipathy towards competence. We know that that's the right way to do it. We're just not going to do it that way. That piece was I was unprepared for the reaction to that. My thought was, I'm writing about the Diamondbacks, right? It's not a huge audience. I mean, obviously, if people will read it. That piece had not been up 6 hours before my phone was blowing up with people in the industry, with more stories coming in that I hadn't even gotten into the piece in the first place, and with the Diamondbacks people starting to spread unpleasant personal rumors about me in response to that, which was really fantastic. Mm-hmm. It was the culmination. I just kept hearing these stories. You know, people loved the gossipy industry, and people love to share stories of other teams' mistakes or incompetence or just stupid stuff people have said. And I kept, you know, I don't usually write about that stuff unless it's directly relevant to something else I'm doing. But I kept hearing more and more stories about Arizona, and we were looking for a topic for me to write about. And went to my editors and said, you know, I've got kind of a decent amount of material here. I'd like to kind of go through. This is a badly run organization, and it's just going to get worse over time. Let's talk about everything they've screwed up so far. And then when I sat down to do it, it was even an even longer list than I'd realized. Once I made a couple more calls and asked people who'd dealt with Stewart, used to work there prior to, you know, other GMs who'd tried to negotiate with Stewart had a lot to say about dealing with him. And just the more I dug, the more stuff came up. Like I said, even more came up after it was published. So it was kind of a perfect storm of really incompetent front office with a list of not that hard to learn about mistakes. And they weren't well liked at all. Like even people who say Dave Stewart's a nice guy, but he was impossible to deal with as a GM. Like that also spurs more people to come forward and tell you stuff. Whereas if I tried to do that on a lot of other organizations, I know a lot of people, good people, who I would not maybe feel so comfortable spilling all the beans on. Whereas with Arizona, it's like they weren't good people. They weren't well liked. The people who obviously ended up getting bounced out of there, they were kind of strongly disliked even within their own organization or within the industry. And that made it a little easier for me to come out with something that was a bold proclamation that I have no idea if it did anything to get them fired. But, you know, even if I think somebody probably deserves to get fired, I'd rather not be the catalyst for it myself.
Yes. Okay, so my last question is non-baseball related altogether. Okay. It is board game related. It is tabletop game related. As I've mentioned to you before, my friend, I have a friend here named Tim Kelly who runs a place called the Rook and Pawn, which is
To get there.
Yes, it is a board game cafe.
Tell the University of Georgia to get some better players so I can come scout down there. Yeah. I've been there once. I've been to Athens, Georgia once in my life. That seems horrible.
Yeah,
for somebody who likes baseball and music. And food.
Yes. And
that's not enough.
And I literally live within a 5-minute walk of that stadium. So just
that's right.
We're crying out loud. Like in the very, yes. Like there's a standing date for us to go to a game and then go to Rook and Pawn and drink and play these games. But I'm still new to that universe. So here's my question for you as someone I've read many of your reviews on this. And I'm still, you know, I still play. I think when I've gone there, I don't even play like Strat-O-Matic. I play those old All-Star baseball games where you spin the little wheel and Babe Ruth has a 3 for a walk and a 10 for a strikeout. Like it's a very, very silly game. So putting the baseball aside, is there, as someone like me who sees a lot of people having fun at that cafe, doing some of the more complex games, but is there for me, if I'm going to go there, I want to get more into the kind of smarter games that you and Tim are into. What's a good gateway game for me and others to kind of get me started and get that ball rolling? Because their cocktails are really good. So I'd be perfectly happy to sit there for hours and drink a lot of them until I accidentally destroy a country in my game or something. Give me a good gateway game.
The one nice thing about a lot of these games that I like is you rarely do these games involve someone getting eliminated entirely. So like no one's upending the table. No one's throwing drinks at each other, you know, unless you're playing like diplomacy, where often players get knifed in the back in reality, because that's it. I mean, it's kind of what the game is about. You know, most of these, like they're not going to end in tears for anybody. Carcassonne is the one I always say it's my favorite overall game because it's really simple to learn. There's a fair amount of complexity to the strategy, but not to the rules. The rules fit on two sides of a piece of paper. And to me, that's like that kind of elegance in board game design is incredibly important. There's a lot of brilliant games that are really well liked that have 20-page rule books. And most people don't want to make that investment. If I was not actually reviewing these games for Paste, I would probably not play a game with a 20-page rule book. Or the one I reviewed last week, the box weighs 7 pounds because there's that many pieces in it. Like that's we're in Cones of Dunshire territory at that. In fact, I even said in my review that game needs a ledgerman. I wasn't kidding. Like, so there was somebody there who was just doing the accounting that would actually make it a better game. The other one that I often recommend, and there's like a trillion expansions to it now, is Dominion, which is a cards-only game. There's not actually a board. Each player starts with a small deck of cards, and you use them to buy or acquire other cards and build your deck out. And each turn, you draw five cards. You do what you can with those, and you shuffle them back into the deck, etc. And another one, it's very easy to pick up, and there's a ton of expansions. There's a ton of different ways to play. It's one of those games that if you learn that, you've learned a mechanic that is now used in a bunch of other games that mimic Dominion style. But also you could play Dominion for years and never run out of different combinations and never run out of ideas of how to play. And like I said, it's easy, anything that's easy to pick up, because like I said, there are great games. Agricola is one of those that's very highly rated if you go to Board Game Geek, because, you know, the selection bias at work there. These are people who are, they're geeks by definition. Like, they love complex games. I like a complex game now and then, too. I'm not recommending that to people who ask you what you just asked me for a gateway drug. Oh, sorry, game. You said game, right? Not drug.
Sure, let's go with game. Right.
Let's go with game, absolutely. Yeah, those are two that I always put at the top. And I will say, because I know you have kids who are probably pre-board game age now, but getting there, Ticket to Ride was one of the first that my daughter loved, because she does dig board games, as long as they don't have 20-page rule books. And it's a train game. You're building routes of trains on a map. The base game is the United States, and it helped her learn a little geography. It's, you know, oh, daddy's been there and daddy's been there. It's, and it's just color matching and trains. It's very kid friendly, but not stupid. Like, I think a lot of the games we played when I was a kid, like Sorry is stupid. That's a stupid game. Candyland, I always say, is the game to teach your kids if you want to show them that life is pointless and random. Like, and I assume you've played Candyland with your kids and done what I've done, which is, hey, look over there. And then you just flip through the deck to make the game end sooner.
Yes, I do that with most things with them, actually.
Yeah, actually, yes, that's probably, yeah. How old is your older one? Is
five.
How old?
Five, either okay. Five and two, both boys.
Yeah, so you're getting to the point where there's like a little more of an attention span there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but when my daughter was like 3 and 4 and she would see us playing games, well, I want to play too. It's all right, let's take out one of your games. Oh God, I want to die. Like quickly, actually, because this is a slow death. Yes. Now she's 10, so she can play pretty much anything. Now she's essentially one of my testers, because if she plays something and says it's not good, then that's actually good information for the review.
Well, if Georgia ever gets a halfway decent baseball team again, we will go out and we will play one of these games at the Rook and Pawn after, or more likely, when you come out to see Florida players play at Georgia,
you will. I was going to try to do that this year for that Missouri series, and then they had that travel nightmare, and I couldn't find out the team. Wasn't sure what night they were going to pitch the pitcher I particularly wanted to see, and then I got rerouted to California anyway. But I had the whole thing set up. It's like, I'm going to Athens this year. And then like 3 days before I was supposed to go, it's like, I'm not going to Athens this year at all.
Well, okay. The last thing is, I just kind of want to say something. Two last things I want to say before we wrap up here. One, longtime followers of Keith on Twitter, I'll have you know, we're doing this interview over Skype. I am looking at the pie icon. He has not changed the pie icon on Skype. I'm looking at the pie icon. So for those of you that have been like, so whenever the endless shameless shilling of this book is over, and by the way, that's the only shilling reference we're going to have in this podcast.
Yeah, I was just going to say, don't say shilling. It's trigger warning, please. Sorry.
I just caught myself like, no, okay, is it hawking? There we go. You and Andre Dawson have no disagreements. the endless hawking of the book. We can get back to the pie icon, because I miss the pie icon. And the second thing is, like, in all honesty, like, you know, one of my big things about working in sports is I never really intended to work in sports. It was always like a little bit of an accident. I that's been kind of happened because I was working on other things. And I thought, okay, this is the only way I would want to write about sports, is if I were able to do it that way. And because I truly love sports, but sports was never something I thought I would write about on a regular basis. But for me, and particularly as I see a lot of the other people who write about sports, I was like, okay, this is probably that was probably why I didn't want to get into this. But I have to say, there are people out there, and they're more and more, frankly, than age of the internet. One of the great things, whatever we may complain about getting yelled at on Twitter, but for me, there are so many new voices now, and so many different voices, and so many voices that didn't have a voice 10 years ago out in the world. It's very exciting for me as a consumer to listen to. But like, Keith, you have always kind of represented to me like someone who is doing this for the right reasons. And so I just wanted to say I love the book, but like, generally speaking, I'm just generally a huge, huge fan, and I'm just honored that you come on and yak with me for a little bit.
Well, thank you. I've been looking forward to this for a while, and I will even forgive you for saying awful things about Fletch, which is actually one of the funniest movies of all time.
I don't know, man. I'm getting a rash just thinking about Chevy Chase.
You ever
man.
See a spleen that enlarged before? No, not since Breakfast.
It's funny because
that's comedy gold, Will.
It's funny because one of the things that Tim and I do on our Grist and Lace podcast is, you know, when we review those movies, we try not to get too caught up in, okay, this would not fly in today. Like, this is a dated joke. This is a, like, you know, the trading places has a literalist scene of Dan Aykroyd in Rasta blackface. Like, I ran out of the room when I saw that. I started looking around to make sure that nobody saw me watching that. But like, the movie itself is not bad because of that thing. And so for me, we always try to keep that out a little bit. But man, Fletch has got a lot of those, and Fletch has a lot of those specifically from not from, like, you know, Dan Aykroyd's trying to make a joke. It's Chevy Chase is trying to show about how he is better than everyone else. And that is, I have a Chevy Chase issue. I've liked him in the vacation movies. Literally the only time I've ever liked Chevy Chase was in the vacation movies, because he's the butt of every joke in that movie, right? Even if he doesn't realize it. And my problem with Fletch is that he's not the butt of the joke. That's my issue with Fletch. And that's my issue with Chevy Chase in general.
There you go. Well, I will just to, since you brought up the whole blackface thing, you should reboot, Holiday Inn, which is itself not actually a good movie. It's basically good music, you know, of that time. Irving Berlin song stitched together with a terrible plot and one of the most horrible blackface scenes I've ever seen in a movie, which if you catch it on TV, you won't see it. Like, all of a sudden, it's just, how did Lincoln's birthday just not have, like, right? They talked about it and it's gone. And then there's a blackface. There's a reference to it that makes no sense. We have the DVD version, and every time it's like, skip. We explain to our daughter what that means, why that's horrible. But it's like, yep, there it is. Yeah, can't do that. It was 1941. People thought that was okay.
Reminds me a little of my children do not watch. They're young enough that they don't watch too much TV though. Now that they're two, you know, now there's two right. of them. It's a little harder. One thing I did when they introduced my son to were old Bugs Bunny cartoons. I loved those as a kid, and I think they're visually inventive and very and just, you know, just clever and hilarious. But like, every once in a while, you're like, oh, yep, Bugs Bunny is very problematic right now. Like, some of those early ones are some of the ones that there's like a Civil War one that
I grew up on those. There were some where I'd like catch them again, you know, as a little bit older, flipping channels. It's like, that was funny.
That's okay, we were young anyway. Keith, thank you for your time. Everyone, buy the book. It's Smart Baseball, the story behind the old sets that are ruining the game, the new ones that are running it, and the right way to think about baseball. Keith, it's a great book, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so everyone have a great week. Enjoy. Go buy Keith's book. It's really good. It's out literally tomorrow, correct? Tuesday the 25th.
25th, yes. 25th. Okay, absolutely.
Go out and buy it, or just pre-order it. Mine's going to be showing up in my mailbox probably around the time that this airs. So, Keith, thank you. Everyone, have a great week. Subscribe. Always subscribe to us on iTunes. Give us a nice review. Music's by the Sundogs, so on. Have a great week, everyone. Thanks to Keith. Bye.